Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And today I'd like to welcome to the program Chang-Rae Lee. His novel, The Surrendered, has just come out in paperback. He joins us by telephone from Princeton, New Jersey, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
Welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Vic.
Chang-Rae, this is the first book of yours I have read, I confess. And now I'm going to have to go back and read the others because, wow, you just really know how to tell a story. How did you become a writer?
Well, I was one of those kids who, was always in the corner reading a book and never really thought about writing so much. But at some point, you know, if you read enough books and you love it and you start thinking, well, perhaps I'd like to give this feeling that I'm having as a reader to someone else. So I started tinkering around in middle school. And then when I started high school, I met some great writing teachers, and they encouraged me, and so I started writing then, mostly poetry, actually, at the start.
I was going through the press packet that they sent along with the book, and I see where you found out something about your dad that you didn't know, and it ended up kind of planting a seed, which sort of starts the book.
Yeah. When I was in college, I was taking this course on Korean history, and of course, I knew that my father had lived through the Korean War, and so for an assignment in that class, I decided to do a little interview and reporter-at-large kind of story on him and his experience. So I was just kind of idly, you know, chatting with him and not really thinking much. But then we started getting into some of his experiences and memories, and one of the things that he talked about was his refugee journey from the north of Korea. He grew up in what is now North Korea before the war, and their southward journey during the first days of the war, when it turned out that he'd lost two siblings during that journey, particularly one of the siblings was killed in an incident that I'd never heard from him, and that I eventually used as a, you know, as a kind of structure for the opening chapter of this novel. But it always amazed me that he was, they'd been so quiet about it. He never really talked about the war, and when he did, it was, you know, in a very casual and almost affable manner. But once he started talking about this particular incident, I could see he was pretty profoundly affected.
It's always a delicate dance when you're talking about a novel to talk about it and yet not to give away too much, but to entice the reader, potential reader, to pick up the book and crack it open. And obviously, you were doing the dance right there, talking about that incident. We didn't give away too much. How do we talk about this story without giving away too much?
Well, I'm not so worried about giving away too much.
Okay.
A lot of things happen. It is a story that's about three main characters who meet during the Korean War, one a Korean refugee girl who's young during the war, age 11 and 12, an American GI, and also an aid worker, a missionary's wife. So there are three main characters. And because it's a story that does have to do with conflict and violence, there are a lot of pretty egregious things happen to these folks. Mostly separately and in one incident together, and really it's a story about how these people are putting their lives back together, or in some cases and in other cases trying to escape life. You know, for me, it's a book that traces the after effects of this kind of really intense and singular experience.
Chang-Rae Lee joins us. His book is The Surrendered. What's the significance of the title?
Well, for a while I didn't quite know what to title the book, but I began to, and it's kind of funny because you think you start writing a book because you know absolutely what it's about, but actually that's not quite the case. You think you know what it's about, but as the book emerges, and sometimes as you write it, the book takes on a life of its own and takes a direction of its own, I began to see a certain commonality to a lot of the characters and had a sense of this theme of surrender. Obviously, in a wartime setting or context, we all know what to surrender means, but in this particular, you know, context in my book, I'm really more interested in, of course, you know, a certain kind of private surrender that these people undergo, a surrender to, of course, the great forces of destiny, you know, as just individuals are when they're caught in a wartime action, but also, I guess, a kind of surrender to their own selves, the selves that they become during and after, you know, such experience. And sometimes that surrender isn't a positive one at all. Often it's not. And also, of course, there's also a sense that these folks are surrendering to each other, again, for better and for worse. So, you know, I guess it's an idea of a certain kind of seeding that's both active and passive.
So how do you crawl inside the heads of these characters? Because you clearly have, and a couple of them are women, and I'm wondering how you get inside the head like that, and you can see out through their eyes, because it's an amazing trick.
Yeah, it's something that I think you learn over time as a writer. Maybe you're not so concerned about whether the outward statistics of a person, whether they're female or a certain age. But you really think more about their experience. And for me, it's also partly trying to draw things from, you know, my own life and my own emotions. And, you know, sometimes I like to say that every single one of the characters I've written, you know, over four novels, this is my fourth, that every character has a little tiny piece of me in them.
Mm.
It's sort of the tiny piece of me that would be expressed if I were in that position, if I were that person in that particular situation with a particular consciousness. So it just takes a lot of thought, but also, you know, beyond the thought, I guess, a certain kind of empathy. And I think writers train themselves into a certain, you know, into a trance of empathy, at least to make themselves believe that they're writing with authentic feeling.
Hector is quite a character. Hector,
he's the American GI.
The GI, Hector Brennan. He grew up in New York State and ended up in the Korean War. He's incredibly good-looking, despite the way he abuses himself with alcohol and his lifestyle is a hard lifestyle. But for some reason, he's still just this incredibly handsome guy, and yet it seems like he's cursed in a way. It seems like just about everything he touches goes bad, and he goes through life just almost afraid to touch anything because he just has such a history of being hurt every time he does.
Yeah, he definitely feels as if he's a curse or a contagion upon whatever scene he arrives. And as you say, he is someone who's physically, you know, beautiful, pristine, perfect. He's almost godlike that way, and I wrote him to be that way, at least on the surface of things. I like the idea that he was a sort of demigod, you know, this creature of perfection, at least, again, on outwardly. But of course, inside, you know, he's full of ruination and regret and anger and you know, a lot of sadness and a lot of confusion too. He's you know, for me, he's absolutely a fallen hero, someone, and maybe a fallen god. There's a tinge to the immortal about him, which I think he himself finds to be a curse. You know, his wounds heal. He never seems to stay down very long, at least physically. And for him, particularly, it's a curse because I think he has a death wish. As you said, it seems to him that he brings misery upon others, whether he intends it or not. So he's begun to shy away from the world and from himself.
It's like he wants to obliterate himself, but he can't do it.
No, no, he's and that's of course the irony of it. I mean, you know, a lot of people have asked me about the book, have asked about him, and a kind of, you know, Greek, you know, classical Greek context to the book. You know, obviously his name is Hector, and Hector, of course, is the noble son of Troy. But he's not quite noble. He has maybe the physicality of Achilles, but he has no nobility whatsoever. He's someone who, as you say, who drinks too much, who womanizes, who gets into fights. He's not, and yet and what the other characters, I think, feel about him is that there's this genuine decency about him, that he strives for something better and of light, but he feels in looking at himself that he's just full of darkness.
And he's this brutally gorgeous man who ends up with these horrible occupations.
Yeah, and during the war, of course, he works in what was called graves registration, which is basically the body handling. So I'd like the idea too that you know he welcomed the horror of that kind of muck, you know, the leftovers of humanity. And again, because he's kind of communing with it in a kind of miserable way.
There's a comfort in it. He's cleaning.
Yeah.
He's a cleaner.
Yeah, he's cleaner, and I guess because no one else wants to do it. And in a way, that's how he's communing with his fellow man.
Yeah.
It's perverse.
Uh-huh.
But I think it, for me, emotionally, it's as much as he can do. Of course, he meets the missionary's wife, and there's a sparkle there. It's momentary.
And you go back into Sylvie, the missionary's early years. You have three basic time frames here. One is in Manchuria in the 30s as the Japanese are invading. Then we have Korea in the 50s, initially during the war and then mostly afterwards. And then you have a suburb of New York City in the 80s. Is that right?
Yeah, and the 80s is the present time story when the orphan girl, now grown up, reconnects with Hector, and they're older now, middle aged, and they're going to take a little pilgrimage to a little church in Italy that Sylvie, the missionary, had told them about, and so the story spans, you know, a lot of time, and in this way, it's not really a book that's discreetly about the Korean War. I don't really see it that way. Mm. It uses the context of the war, and that's the staging area and it predicates certain actions for the characters. But each of the characters has, as you mentioned, Hector has a whole life in upstate New York before the war, and June, of course, has June the orphan girl has her story at the start of the war, and Sylvie has her experience with her missionary parents in Manchuria, and all those stories have a kind of linkage, thematic linkage to them.
And you just mentioned the key word a moment ago when you said pilgrimage, because to me, that is the word I would use to describe what this story meant to me. It's a story of pilgrimage, and we're all on a pilgrimage of some kind. We're all pilgrims, and who knows where we're headed, but we're all headed somewhere, aren't we?
Well, yeah, I mean, these characters are obviously, they're all searching for something. And even if we don't patently and say to ourselves we're on a search, I think whenever you look back, you kind of see that you were. You know, for me as in my career, you know, in many ways I'm always searching for stories and searching for language and searching for all those things. I mean, I'm not thinking that when I'm, you know, at my desk, but as I look back on the books that I've written, it's clear how much of it is this, you know, this kind of anxious discovery, uh-huh. sometimes unconscious.
Yeah.
And the characters in this book are, you know, I don't think they're, you know, there is one conscious kind of search. June searches for her son, but I don't think she quite knows what she wants to find.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what, I think that's the you know, it gets to a certain kind of nature of what goes on in this book for these people. they're desperate for something. They all have a certain kind of hunger, and the pangs of that hunger are what drive them.
An unquenchable thirst.
Yeah.
I must say, this book could have been a lot longer because you have a couple of characters who are on the periphery. They're sympathetic characters. As a reader, I'm starting to like these characters. I'm not going to say who they are. But in one fell swoop, in probably the most dramatic, fast-paced thing that happens in the story, you just erase them from the page. Just boom, like that. I thought, what is this, like masterful editing here? Did he not want to spend the 200 pages bringing these people through the story?
Well, I think the book is already 500 pages long. I couldn't have another 200.
It was longer, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I like when things happen kind of swiftly and intensely in a book, whereas most of the book, as a lot of my books, my previous three books, have been quite quiet, but they've always been marked by some inundating action, and there's something about it that attracts me, and particularly in this instance, you know, it's something that I wanted to put in to kind of, I don't know, re-gear the book and push it off in a whole new direction.
Well, you did. I hit that page and I went back and I read it again and again and again. It was kind of like my groceries had been scattered all over the street and I had to pick them up, put them back in the bag.
Yeah. And I think one of the things about this scene, it's a scene where two characters meet their demise. It's actually a scene that's told from the point of view of June, who is the orphan girl who's grown up, and but in the present time she's terminally ill. She has cancer and she's dying, and she's, you know, under the influence of lots of medications and of course suffering from pain. And it's told through her point of view, which I think adds to the you know, sort of swiftness and eeriness of that moment.
Well, the thing about June is she's the first character we get to meet, and she's a tough character because she's going through so much. And I read some of the press materials about your book, and I saw a couple of reviewers said, oh, she's hard to like, she's unsympathetic. But to me, of the three main characters, she's the one I like the best because she's strong, and they're weak.
Yeah, she's, I think she's described as this, you know, this instrument, this hard instrument. There's something about her that, you know, she endures. Nothing is going to stop her in her, you know, we were talking about search before and her quest. And she literally starts out the book starving, literally starving, thirsty, hungry, bereft of everything, including her family. And she's someone who's turned herself into this kind of magnificent living machine, and that nothing is going to stop her, that she does have this drive for being immortal. And of course there's a cost to that, but I think that's why people see her as a character that's quite complicated. She is hard, she's unrelenting, she can be brutal, and yet there's something, at least for me, there's something about her vitality that really attracted me, something about her desire for life.
Well, she's just an incredibly tough survivor, and yet she's also someone who doesn't miss much. She's very much aware of what's going on around her.
Yeah, she's someone who moves forward, and that's how I saw it, and it's partly why I wrote the first chapter the way I did. I won't go into it very much, but basically the first chapter propels her into the rest of the story, and literally, she's not looking back. Of course, again, you know, nothing's ever black and white. I mean, she does look back in certain ways, at least parts of her consciousness look back. She also has this strange relationship with a son of hers, and she's, again, that's maybe indicative of all the things that she didn't quite have time for as this woman who's, you know, made a life for herself, been quite successful in New York, but now finds herself on the brink of oblivion.
Chang Rae Lee joins us. His novel, The Surrendered, has just come out in paperback, and he'll be at Books & Company on Friday, March 11th for a book signing at 7 o'clock. That's Books & Company in Beaver Creek, Dayton, Ohio area. I must say, I was tickled by the fact that while we find out a lot of things and there's a lot of mysteries that are solved, you don't neatly tie the package all together. You leave some details untold and unsolved and unexplained, and I really like that. And I also like the fact that the mysterious centerpiece of the book is a book, and it's, to me, a message that books are so powerful. And I thought that must be something that you share with me as a thought.
Well, in the book, in my book, the book that you're talking about is, it does have a sacredness to it. It's a talisman. It's a charm. It's an inspiration for the characters. And of course, in the context of the book, it means one thing. But outside of it, I can't help but, as a writer and someone who read a lot of books in his life and continues to read a lot of books, that I can't help but look at a book and just think of, that it contains story. And that's sort of why I'm not yet a Kindle person. For me, and people have asked me, do you use a Kindle and what do you think about it? And I think, oh, great, if it allows people to read and kids to read more books, then, it can't be a bad thing. But, a book for me is not just letters in a certain order, which is somehow how the Kindle kind of presents it, right? I mean, it's all the books look the same on the Kindle. Mm-hmm. And you read them the same way, and you turn the page the same way. And so it reduces all the, the infinite variety of books to the same kind of thing. It maybe suggests that books just are, conglomerations of language and collections of language. But to me, it's not that. A book is a singular thing. And Borges said it once. There's a great quote from Jorge Luis Borges, the great Argentinian writer, who says, a book is a set of symbols that's meant for a particular reader. And I always see that there is a relationship between a reader and the book. And that the book itself, is not just the language, not just these symbols, but also, this object. And an object that we should, continue to revere, and I hope we do.
Well, Borges might have lost his temporal eyesight, but he had wonderful vision.
He did. And I met him once, actually.
Really?
Yeah, right before, I think a couple of years before he died. He was blind. He visited my high school and did a reading there.
Wow.
He read some of his poetry. And after the reading, I was the editor of the poetry magazine at the time. So I was made sure to be at the event, and I had read his stories, and I was just amazed that he was there, and I shook his hand. And he was very kind, very old and frail, but absolutely, as you said, absolutely, the fellow, I felt as if he could see. The way he spoke about poetry and the power of language and story.
I predict eventually they'll come out with e-book readers that have a scent like a musty book. I'm like you. I have bookshelves full of books, and every one of them, when I see that spine, there's a different story in my mind of where that book came from, when I read it.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a little transportation device,
uh-huh.
Right? A teleporter back to that moment.
Mm.
You have a relationship with it, which may change. I guess it will change as we go on, but I hope not. The things I like in this world are things that make you feel connected to something else, either through intellect or even emotionally and physically. That's why I like to cook, for example.
Ah.
And so those are the things that are attractive to me. And a book is a great book is something that that you just love to hold and cherish, and that you don't even have to read sometimes. Because you're reading, as you suggested, you're reading some other kind of narrative that about an experience that you'd had.
Well, Chang Ray, we really appreciate your time today.
Well, it was great to talk to you, Vic.
Our guest has been Chang-Rae Lee. His book is The Surrendered. It just came out in paperback. And you can meet him. He'll be at Books & Company on Friday, March 11th, for a book signing at 7 o'clock for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for listening. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.